this episode, you won't hear much from me. I'm going to help frame the story, but I've largely turned this episode over to my guest. When Brooke was 16 years old, she was raped by an acquaintance who had been harassing her for several months. Beginning in her mid-20s, Brooke began dealing with the long-term effects of the assault, and she had made huge strides in healing from the trauma. But then in September 2018, one woman's accusations of sexual assault against a powerful man turned social media into a debate over the believability of people who come forward decades later. And this debate triggered Brooke's past trauma, and she decided to deal with it in a way she has never done before. This story you're about to hear has only been heard by 5 or 6 people in the last 25 years. I'm Charlie, and this is Impact Statement. When a crime ends in a conviction, the victims or their families are often allowed to give a statement to the court about the impact of the crime on their lives. But when these life-altering events go unsolved, do not end in a conviction, or maybe aren't crimes at all, the victims and their families do not have this opportunity. The stories on this podcast are their impact statements.
When I first met the person who did this to me, I was 15 years old. Basically, I had two best friends in high school, and one of them was friends with an older crowd, and he was part of this older crowd. So when I was 15, he was around 24. And at 15, I was a pretty troubled kid. I came from a household that was abusive is a fair word to say. My parents were not happy with each other. So that kind of turned on me. And there was a lot of emotional and some physical abuse thrown at me to the point that I ended up leaving home and living with other families within a year of this incident. So I was already going through a hard time.
That was Brooke. Not only was Brooke's home life stressful, she was also largely isolated in school. She had grown up in a city, but had moved to a small town in Indiana where she never felt like she fit in. But she did connect with two other teens in high school, and one of them introduced her to this older crowd, men in their early to mid-20s, hanging out with high school girls. Her friend had a crush on one of the men who hung out in this group.
We would be over there, and this guy named Chad would come out of his room, and he would sort of jokingly try to pull me into his bedroom. And he had done that actually in the nude before. And I was 15. I was really uncomfortable with it. But at the same time, I didn't think of myself as this 15-year-old kid. I just thought of it as, I guess this is like this adult joke or whatever. And I would, you know, could just tell him no and put it down. I had a boyfriend. I was very much in love. Even if I didn't, I was so not interested. But my best friend was. She had a huge crush on this guy, and she was actually jealous of these things that he would do, which in retrospect it's pretty messed up, but that was the experience at the time, and I would just rebuff it. I had just gotten involved with my first serious boyfriend. I was madly in love with him because my home life was so stressful that I took a lot of refuge in my relationship with my boyfriend.
After Brooke turned 16, the boyfriend who was her anchor in the storm of her life moved to Illinois. They tried to stay together, but without cell phones and social media, one stayed away might as well have been the other side of the country. They broke up a few months after the move, leaving Brooke devastated and alone. About a month after the breakup, her friend invited her to a graduation party. Even though Brooke wasn't entirely comfortable with this older group of friends, she needed an outlet. She was actively trying to find her community.
I guess I was just happy to get invited to this party. And my mom was actually really strict, and I was shocked that she let me go. But I must have just begged and begged and begged, and I got to go, and I was going to spend the night. And so I went to this party, and there were some teenagers there my age, but there was also a group of mostly guys, I think all guys actually, in their mid-20s. And there was drinking going on, and I didn't drink and do drugs a lot like in high school. I barely smoked a little pot and maybe drank a couple times. It just wasn't really for me. And I was trying to fit in. So I was drinking. You know, I'd been there for several hours, and this guy that his name is Chad, and he was, you know, the friend of a friend. He was hanging around me and just being kind of normal and nice at first and giving me beers and then offering to smoke pot with me. And I was so drunk that I wasn't like wasted by that point, but I was willing to say yes, even though I didn't really want to smoke weed. But at a certain point in the night, he changed towards me and he became very sexually aggressive, and he started following me from room to room, trying to basically drag me into an upstairs bedroom. And I told him no several times. I don't even remember anybody stepping in to try to kind of defuse the situation. Maybe somebody did, but I don't remember. That's part of the confusion of the story, is I wasn't 100% sober. I remember the more traumatic events, but because you do encode trauma in your brain differently than you do just, you know, basic everyday things. But I mean, I remember trying to go to the bathroom and him popping in, and while I was trying to go to the bathroom and trying to grab me. I mean, it was very physical like that. And him kind of acting like it's a joke, but not. And I was so frustrated with it. And I think my best friend had left by then, and I had to spend the night because there's no way I could go home smelling like alcohol. Like I was actually a good kid. Like, I didn't sneak out. I didn't really drink normally or do drugs. I made good grades, like, and I still got in trouble all the time with my parents. So if I had gone home smelling like alcohol, it would have been just over for me. So I had to spend the night. But I do remember a point in time I got so frustrated that I went outside and sat in, I think it was my car, to just kind of calm down and get away from this guy who wouldn't leave me alone. And at some point, I was sitting in my car and he actually found me and got in the car. And I remember just being so exasperated that he got in my car, like he hunted me down like that. And I got to a point of just kind of pleading with him to leave me alone, that I wasn't interested. I remember telling him, I didn't even point out the obvious. I'm 16 and you're 25, and there's an ick factor. Also, I knew he had a girlfriend, like all the things. Like, I didn't even go that route. I just said, you know, I just lost the love of my life. I'm really not interested. And I said, I don't like sex with strangers. I had only been with one partner, and it was, you know, this one boyfriend that I had loved, and he was special to me. And I think I still had hopes that we would get back together too. I mean, I just didn't want to do anything with this guy. And I even got to the point where I told him something that I don't normally tell people, but I had been molested when I was like a toddler, and that I could remember it, and that I, because of that, I didn't even enjoy sex. And I mean, that's at least with strangers, you know, but I kind of exaggerated it as a way to, like, this thing that girls learn to do to appease guys, to try to, like, let's not make them upset, but let's try to get them to leave us alone in a different way. So I went like the pity route, like, I've been molested, I'm not interested, please leave me alone. And he acted like he totally was going to back off, that, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, like, I can't believe that happened to you, you know, let's go inside and sit down, it's fine, I'll leave you alone. And so I naively believed him, and I remember going inside and sitting at their kitchen table. And because I had drank, and I think he even gave me another beer, and smoked pot, I got very tired and I was starting to pass out. And I guess he really didn't want that. So he started giving me pills. And at the time, like, I was so kind of out of it and passing out that I didn't even know what I was taking. I found out later they were like no-dos or like whatever truckers took to stay awake back then, you know, like maybe ephedrine or something like that. But I remember he gave them to me like candy because I guess he really didn't want me to fall asleep. And my next memory after that is my heart started racing, probably as a result of these pills, and I started to feel really sick. And he acted like he was so concerned and I just needed to lay down and go to bed. And I remember him picking me up and carrying me into that upstairs bedroom.
A warning. This is where the details of the assault are covered. While not graphic, this story may be disturbing to some listeners. If you want to skip, fast forward about 4 minutes.
So it's probably about 2 or 3 in the morning, and he literally, he's a not very tall guy, but he's very, very strong and muscular and buff, like he was a weightlifter. And I knew from my friend's friend that this group of guys did steroids too. He was just very strong. So he just picked me up and carried me into that bedroom. And I thought he was going to, in my drunken stupor on whatever drugs, you know, I thought he was going to tuck me in and put me to sleep. And he laid me down. And instead of tucking me in, he started to take his clothes off. And he started pressuring me to have sex with him. And by pressuring, I mean just telling me I was going to do it. And I told him no several times. I don't even know how many times. I mean, dozens of times. And it didn't matter. I don't really want to go into all the details of what happened, but I'll say he did use a condom, which is important to the story later. But he used a condom, and in my drunken state and how strong he was, I didn't have a chance to fight this guy off. And at some point, I just gave in and gave in to the coercion, gave in to the pushing me around and, you know, everything. And I just sort of let it happen. At least that's how I looked at it then. And I just gave up fighting. Because at first I thought someone would even hear in another room and maybe come stop it. But nobody did. And I just gave up. So it happened. He raped me. And afterwards, though, actually during it, I started experiencing something I'd never experienced before, which is a panic attack. And I know what they feel like now because I've had them ever since. So that was my very first panic attack. And I thought I was dying, you know, in my mind after it happened, the bigger issue is I think I'm having a heart attack and dying, thinking about that more than what the heck just happened to me. And what was confusing to my like not fully developed brain and understanding manipulation and things like that is he acted so caring afterwards. He stayed in the room. He stayed up with me all night because I couldn't sleep and my heart raced all night long. And he watched me, and maybe he thought, you know, he needed to watch because I might get sick and die. I don't know what his, you know, overdose, throw up, whatever. I don't know what his reasoning was for doing it, but he watched me all night long. And then when I started to feel a little bit better, the sun was out. So this went on for hours. I was stuck in the same room with the guy that did this to me, confusing the hell out of me by acting like he cared. And then when the sun came up, he told me to get up and he put his clothes on and everything. And then he walked me outside and I didn't know what was going on. He was leaving and he was having me walk him out for some reason. And then I remember outside his car, he leaned down and he kissed me goodbye. And I just stood there stunned because in my mind, I had told this guy no so many times, like, why would he think that this is some romantic thing? And I didn't kiss him back, but he kissed me and then he left. And I remember thinking, I guess I wasn't clear enough with him. And this was just a huge mistake. And he thought that I wanted this. And I did not say no enough. I wasn't clear enough because there's no way that someone this nice who watched me when I was sick, who kissed me goodbye, would have knowingly raped me. And that was a story I told myself at 16 that I clung to, that this didn't happen to me, that I wasn't really raped, that I just wasn't very clear with somebody. And this thing I didn't want to happen happened. I knew I didn't want it to happen. I knew I tried to get my point across. But it never even crossed my mind to go to the police about what happened, because what happened was so confusing to me that I thought, wow, I guess this is my fault. And I walked around feeling like this was my fault for a long time.
Because Chad used a condom and left it behind at the house, those living there knew some type of sexual contact had happened in that room. And it got back to Brooke's best friend, who, if you remember, had a crush on Chad. Brooke lost her best friend, and bullying soon followed as the story went through their high school.
I got punished every day for the next 2 years before I left school. I was called a slut, a whore. I was bullied physically. Her other group of friends would shove me down in the hallways. It's kind of a longer, deeper story than that, but she did everything she could to punish me. And my only answer to people was, it didn't happen. I don't know where that condom came from. It wasn't ours. He just watched me all night because I was sick. That was the story I stuck to. And it's almost like I convinced myself of it, because I so knew I couldn't convince anyone of anything else, because there was a condom left behind. I was already labeled a slut and a whore.
Brooke walked around for 9 years with the story she told herself of Chad simply misreading the situation. At the age of 25, the same age her rapist was when it happened, Brooke moved to California. She had finished college and was motivated to put Indiana in her rearview mirror. The abuse at home, the rape, and the bullying were all things she wanted to flee. But she soon realized that the impact of these things had followed her through college and to California.
And then for that period in college, like the rest of high school through college, I had a couple boyfriends, and I would try to have, you know, a normal sex life for the next few years. And I would suddenly just feel sick during sex. And I would feel like I was going to throw up, like all the feelings I had from those panic attacks before and the pills and especially sexual acts he made me do. Like I would start having flashbacks of it in my head. What I know now are flashbacks. But at the time I was just like, why can't I stop thinking about this? You know, and I did not enjoy sex for a long time. I will say I'm fine now and I can have a great sex life. But for a long time, almost a decade, I did not. And I would cry during sex. I would try so hard to not let it get in my mind, but I'd cry and need to stop. And I had boyfriends who didn't stop. It's like it was just miserable because I so wanted to be normal. And I couldn't be normal no matter how hard I tried.
At the same time, Brooke was reflecting on how the rape at 16 was still affecting her relationship with sex at 25. She saw an article about actress Terry Hatcher opening up about sexual abuse she had endured as a child. She came forward when she learned her abuser had continued abusing other girls over the following 35 years, and she brought the decades-long pattern of abuse to light.
My case was long past the statute of limitations, so I was not able to prosecute, but he could use my deposition to establish a pattern and credibility. So I did. I told my story. I broke my silence. And my deposition was read in court, and my uncle took a plea deal. And he went to prison, and he died there.
Terry Hatcher's open and honest accounting of her abuse helped Brooke begin to realize what happened to her was not simply a misunderstanding.
It just kind of awoke this thought in my head, because I think a part of me had started to realize, okay, this wasn't a misunderstanding. You were raped, you know, like in the back of my head for a little while, but I kept kicking myself for not going to the police. Well, if you were raped, you should have went to the police, which is basically the story we hear over and over. If you're assaulted, why don't you go to the police? And I was yelling at myself in my head about it. And the statute, I looked it up at that time, and the statute of limitations, I had assumed before it was up, and I was right. It was like 2 years. So I only had till I was 18 or maybe 20 if they let you go from the time you're an adult. I can't remember. So I'd only had 2 to 4 years max to report this. And that time had passed. So that was part of why I was like, don't even go there in your head, because it doesn't matter. There's nothing you can do about it. And I heard this story where she still did something about it. And it just sort of clicked in my head to start thinking about it. And I ran it through my head again. And I started realizing that all these series of events that happened weren't a misunderstanding. It was a calculated move over and over by a manipulative rapist. I looked at it and I was just thought about myself at that age, if I was 25, having sex with a 16-year-old. It made me sick to my stomach to think about it. Just the difference of power you have from 25 to 16. And then I remembered that I had told this guy, I don't even like sex because you know what? I was molested and I'm not over it. And it's not something I want to do. And who still has sex with that person after that? Not someone who's trying to have sex. This is a fucking rapist. And I thought about the pills he gave me. I'd never really thought about that before, that he was so upset that I might pass out before he got what he wanted that he started giving me speed. And I was getting sick from the speed, and he still thought, oh, this is a good time for her to have sex. No, like, that's not sex. And I thought about me being in that room and saying no a million times. And if I was in the room with anybody who said no that many times, could I somehow miscomprehend that? Like, could I misunderstand that? No. And it just hit me full force. There was no misunderstanding. This was probably even planned on in advance by this guy, because I was invited to this party and he had tried to hit on me so many times before and it didn't work. And I just realized, I was in a trap that whole night. Like, there was no me getting out of that unless someone had come and got me and taken me away from that place.
This realization led Brooke to pursue therapy.
At least I stopped kicking myself. I started thinking of myself more as a victim instead of someone who was to blame and who just wasn't clear enough and who, yeah, had this bad thing happen, but it could have been prevented had I only done something else. Like, looking back on it, what else could I have done? How could I have been more clear? There's no being more clear than that. And I was just, it was just one of those things where it just, like, all of a sudden you realize things aren't what you think they are. And I was just like, that's flashbacks, and this is post-traumatic stress disorder. And I can, it was empowering in a way, because I realized, yes, I'm a victim, and I didn't want to see myself as that before. I actually wanted to shame myself for whatever reason. But if I saw myself as a victim, I could get past it, and I could be a survivor. And maybe I could take back my power, and I could have a normal sex life and enjoy relationships and, you know, things like that. Like, that were just out of reach for me before.
Terry Hatcher's story also inspired Brooke to consider ways she could report the crime, even with the statute of limitations being up. But previous dealings with her local small-town police force discouraged her. She had family members who reported domestic violence but were turned away. And during the time she was being bullied in high school, another student purposely hit Brooke's car. She drove directly to the police station to file a report. She was told by an officer that because she had left the scene of the accident, she also had committed a crime. She explained she had only left the scene to go to the police department to report this incident. Remember, this was before cell phones. The officer just repeated that she was guilty of a crime, which discouraged her from even filing the report. So when considering reporting the rape a decade after it happened, she couldn't find a way to do it that felt safe. Reporting a rape or a sexual assault in a timely manner has been a conversation we have been having for years, but it became one of the most debated topics of 2018. In July 2018, U.S. President Donald Trump released a short list of judges he was considering for appointment to the Supreme Court. A woman anonymously came forward to accuse one man on the list, Judge Brett Kavanaugh, of sexually assaulting her while they were in high school in the 1980s. Her name eventually came out, and Dr. Christine Ford testified about these allegations in front of Congress.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
With what degree of certainty do you believe Brett Kavanaugh assaulted you?
100%.
Many everyday people took to social media to debate largely the believability of both Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh. People asked the question, if Dr. Ford had been assaulted, why didn't she report it? And even if it is true, what does it matter 35 years later? While social media posters may have felt they were speaking specifically to the situation between Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh, their friends and family were the ones who heard and read their comments. And these comments took their toll. For a time reference, I spoke with Brooke shortly after Judge Kavanaugh's appointment to the bench.
When the Me Too movement and Time's Up happened, it gave me so much hope. And I think that's part of why my PTSD symptoms came back horribly during the Kavanaugh hearings, because I guess I had hoped we had come further. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Anita Hill hearings. And I remember at the time feeling so sorry for her, but the way she was treated was horrible. And that was on my mind. And I guess I had thought, well, we're going to see how far we've come. And then seeing how far we haven't come was crushing. And the thing is, I think we came far in the sense of, I feel like most people believe her, but it just didn't matter. They were going to approve him no matter what, because politics mattered more than reality of sexual assault and rape and all these, like, it was really depressing. And the thing is, I think it was depressing for so many people, and women especially, but men who have been victims too. Like, it's a private conversation I've had with a lot of people, that they're walking around with this old PTSD wound they have as well. It's been ripped open and they don't know what to do with it. They're just walking around with a bleeding, like, you know, wound, and they don't know how to make it go away either. And there hasn't been a huge national conversation or even international conversation about what these hearings did to survivors and what do we do with these feelings that we have because of what happened, and especially because of the outcome, which is basically we all went through this and it almost feels like for nothing. We got triggered and re-triggered over and over, and you know, if he had at the end of it not been approved, maybe we would have been like, okay, it's worth it. But instead, we're just walking around feeling re-traumatized and not knowing what to do with it. And we might be talking about it one-on-one, but I don't hear a huge national conversation about it. I'll say that I have had more dreams about being raped and trying to convince people of being raped in the last month or so than I have had since I was 25. I mean, I've had more, I've had the flashback dreams, the panic feelings, it's all come back. And back then I did a lot of work to put the PTSD to bed. I mean, I think I was in therapy for about 3 years. And I just, it's frustrating because you can't get rid of it, but you can put it, you can manage it, and you can put it to bed, and you can learn to deal with the little remnants of it that are left in your life. But to have it come back out full force 15 years later than when you first learned to deal with it it's hard. And it came kind of out of nowhere for me. I wasn't predicting it. I don't think anyone would have predicted what was going to happen. But back then, I did a lot of work to put this to bed, and it just brought, I'll be honest, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it also made me think about other incidents and the coulda, woulda, shouldas, and like, you know, you hear these people in the news or on social media saying, oh, well, you know, with the Kavanaugh hearings, if Dr. Ford was really assaulted, why didn't she go to the police? Why didn't she go to the police? And I just walked around in a fit of rage because I no longer feel responsible for what happened to me. I'm just pissed off, to be honest. And I'm pissed off at who did it to me, but I'm also pissed off about people not believing people like me. Like, we have nothing to gain from coming forward. All we can tell the truth and we'll still be labeled all sorts of horrible things.
And her anger wasn't only from the questions of the believability of those who don't report. It came from a time that she did report an attempted rape and how she was treated. At the time, Brooke had been in California for a few years and lived with a roommate who was a bit naive. They were out one night drinking at a bar where the roommate knew the bartender. The bartender mentioned his girlfriend and her brother needed a place to stay for the night, and Brooke's roommate invited them back to their shared apartment. After getting back to the apartment, Brooke went to bed.
And I woke up in the middle of the night with this strange guy in my bed on top of me trying to force himself on me. And I lived in an apartment. I lived in San Francisco in this teeny tiny apartment where just to make room to live, you had to sleep at the ceiling in a loft bed, and there's just a closet underneath you and a tiny bit of floor. And I woke up with this stranger on top of me. I didn't know this guy from anyone. It was literally my roommate brought him home, and he crawled into my room, crawled up my ladder, and got on top of me. I threw him off of my bed, my loft bed, which was pretty high in the air. He hit the ground hard. So, I mean, I'm proud of myself that I fought this asshole off, but at the same time, it shouldn't have happened. And so he started screaming about this thing that happened to him, and his sister woke up and they got out of there real quick. I can't remember a whole lot of it because, again, I woke up to this and I had been drinking, but I wasn't so drunk that I couldn't remember anything. But I can say that my roommate came in and asked me what happened. I told her and she started crying because she felt responsible. And I'll be honest, it didn't cross my mind to call the police at that moment. We slept a few hours till the sun came up, and I woke up and realized I want to do something different and I want to go to the police. So I did. I had finger mark bruises in my thighs where he had been pulling my thighs apart. And it's very obvious what happened just based on my bruises. And I told the police, and their response to me was, why didn't you call us last night? Or it was really early this morning, you know, why didn't you call us when it happened? And I said, well, I just didn't think of it. And they said, well, if this really happened, why didn't you call the police? I mean, just like I was being interrogated over it. And I said, well, I'm here now. It's not even been 12 hours. I purposefully didn't take a shower just in case you want to do any tests, because I don't really know how far he got, you know, as far as like anything he might have left behind, you know. And they took photos. They took photos of embarrassing photos of my thighs with these marks on them. And I didn't even get a follow-up phone call about it. They did nothing. I found the address within three houses of the guy who did this to me. I had fingerprints basically seared into my skin. You wouldn't believe the bruises I had on my thighs, on my inside of my thighs. There was no way this happened in any other way. I had a witness. You know, like, what more could you ask for? They did nothing. I didn't even get a phone call. And, you know, maybe I should have called them again. But I'll tell you what, I felt so disheartened because I had been kicking myself for so long for not doing something about the guy who actually raped me, that when it happened, I had the resolve. I got up, I figured out where this guy lived, or at least where his parents did when he wasn't in college. I knew he had said something about leaving for college again soon. I knew I had a short window of time to catch him. And I was like, I am going to do the thing. I'm going to report and do the thing they tell you to do. And nothing happened. And they immediately looked for an excuse not to believe me. And that excuse was, why didn't you tell us 12 hours ago? That's what was in my mind in the last month. Why didn't you go to the police? Why didn't you go to the police? Okay. maybe we don't go to the police because we don't know what happened to us at the time. We're too young to really process what happened to us, and we don't understand power dynamics. Maybe we don't go to the police because where we live, it doesn't seem like the police really care. Maybe we don't go because we grew up in a family culture of abuse and things like that that the police have ignored for decades. Maybe we don't go to the police because actually we did go to the police and they didn't believe us because we didn't call 911. Instead, we went in the next day. So that's what I want to say to people who say, why don't you report? Why don't you report? Well, give us a reason to report and we will. Let us be educated enough that we understand what happens to us when it does so that we know to go report. And give us the benefit at least of the doubt that we're not lying when we come to report. And that's the thing. When we say believe victims, we're not saying just go on us coming in and don't investigate. We're saying start with the idea that this could have happened and investigate and look and see if it happened. And if it did, prosecute. Do your job and prosecute. That's it. Give us the same respect you would give someone who got their purse snatched.
Brooke's hope for sharing her story is simple: to bear witness to what happened to her and to name the man who did this. This process can give her some control over how she interacts with her trauma, and she hopes her message is one of hope for healing.
And so I'm doing everything I can again to put this back to bed, and telling this story, I hope, is part of me putting this to bed, because I've barely ever told this story and I've never really named my attacker. His name is Chad. He was 25 years old. I was 16. And there was nothing I could do to stop him. And I tried everything in the amount of power I had as a 16-year-old child, and it didn't work. And I was manipulated into thinking what happened didn't happen, and maybe I shouldn't go to the police because they won't care, or maybe it was just an accident, when it really, in no way, shape, or form, could have been an accident. And by the time I realized that it wasn't, the laws are set in a way that there's nothing you can do about it. I feel privileged that I was able to spend the years in therapy to get where I'm at today over it, that I did study psychology, that I was able to recognize finally, you know, eventually what happened. So I feel privileged that I was able to do that. I feel privileged now that I can afford therapy twice a week to work through this. I feel privileged that I was able to come on this podcast. Not everyone can do that or even knows how to do that, to tell this story and to kind of exercise this demon that's been chasing me around in my head for the last couple months. And I think a lot of people don't even know where to start to get it out, let alone know who will listen. So I'm hoping that by sharing the story, that maybe somebody will turn to somebody else and say, you know what, I do have this story I need to tell, and maybe getting it off my chest will help, or maybe going to therapy is the thing to do right now, or, you know, just finding some way to empower themselves to get past this, because I know I'm not alone in feeling the way I do right now at 40 years old, dealing with a trauma again that happened when I was 16. You don't have to experience trauma the same way every time it comes up. So you kind of have to, you can redefine your relationship with it, which is a huge part of how I've learned to deal with it. But I will say I felt very little control over how I interacted with my trauma over the last couple months, which is a huge part of why I was grateful to come and tell my story here, because I felt like that was me being able to take control a little bit of how I'm interacting with my trauma. I'm trying to do something with it. But it does come and go, and it comes in waves, and it comes when you don't expect it. But I do hope that people realize that maybe if they haven't realized it yet, that they can change their relationship to it. And they can get their power back.
If you are interested in sharing your story on Impact Statement, please email impactstatementpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter @statementpod.